Good evening and welcome to to the last panel in this Democracy Now! Sequence of our Night of Ideas. My name is Lucy Campos. I work for the French Book Office here in London. And I'm very pleased to welcome here tonight three of our French intellectuels and historians of ideas, Christophe Charles, Laurent Jean-Pierre, and Ludovic Frobert. Now, there's an empty chair beside me because Sudhir Hazare Singh from Oxford, who was supposed to come to join this panel tonight, is unfortunately ill, so he's unable to make it. But he sends his excuses and he wishes he could be here because he, I think, was very much enthusiastic about entering this debate about the position of intellectuals in the European public sphere today and what can be said of that history of our intellectual ideas in the context of current questions, interrogations about our European identity and values. So we have three Frenchmen here who have taken part in a collective and important adventure published with Le Seuil this year in Paris. I hasten to say there are not only men on the list of contributions, they're also, I mean, it's very, very well balanced. We just happen to have three male representatives here tonight. Laurent Jean-Pierre is Professor of Political Science at the University of Paris 8. He is specialized in political and cultural sociology, particularly interested in the history of French intellectual life, but also specialist of issues of exile, political migration, and revolutionary and political crisis situations. He's the author of many articles and books, including La culture et ses intermédiaires, et Entre rayonnement et réciprocité, contribution à l'histoire de la diplomatie culturelle. So, a historian not only of issues of exile and migration, but also of culture and of cultural diplomacy. Christophe Charles is Professor of Contemporary History at the University of Paris 1. He is a specialist in comparative cultural history, as well as in the social history of the 19th and 20th centuries. He's published a long list of books on the history of intellectual life in Europe, but also on the place of writers, of the theatre, and of the press. So just a few. There's the Histoire sociale de la France au XIXe siècle, so a social history of France in the 19th century. It's
translated in English.
Which is translated into English. but also La dérégulation culturelle, so cultural deregulation, Essai d'histoire des cultures en Europe, as history of European cultures. Laurent Jean-Pierre and Christophe Charles are the coordinated this whole adventure, of which there are actually two volumes, so I only have one of the volumes here tonight. Ludovic Frobert, based in Lyon, but at the moment in the Maison Française d'Oxford, is senior researcher at the CNRS and specialized in the history of economic and political thought. His work focuses in particular on the 19th century. He has published on economic history and in particular on the history of the Lyon silk weavers in the 19th century and the collective movement that brought them to public notice, and we will hear a little bit more about that maybe later on. Our three speakers are going to start by telling us a little bit more about this collective adventure and what it means and what the project was behind this collective rewriting of the history of French intellectuals and how it is not only French but also talking about connections with other European countries and about trends that are going through the whole of European thought. I think Christophe Charles will start talking. I'm going to give a short time to each of them to tell us a little bit about this. And then we will open at the end of the hour questions and debate with the audience. So Christophe, would you like to start explaining a little bit about this, the project, and what it means or has come to mean in our slightly changed Europe of today?
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you very much for being there at this hour, which is rather late. Our project in this book was to try to go further than only an intellectual history or an history of intellectuals. It was more to bring together all the elements which explain both why France has the specificity of intellectuals as a collective and social actors in the history, and also why this model was not so evident, obvious to be transferred in other countries. And so we wanted to explain why this history is so specific in France and what are the reasons of these specificities. And therefore we had to look at a larger view than only the specificity of each intellectual, this famous writer, this famous philosopher, but to show how they were produced. So we had to look, for example, at the system of education, because in France, as you know, we have a specific tradition of education with this separation between two sectors, the sector of university on one side and the sector of the so-called grandes écoles, which creates a strong cleavage inside the people who are educated in France. The second idea was to look also at the influences from outside, because France is a sort of country where there are influences both from the south, with the Roman tradition, with the Italian influences, with the Spanish influences, but also France is also, and especially in the 19th century, strongly regarding towards England because of questions about the evolution in politics. England was thought by some thinkers in France, such as Guizot or Tocqueville, as a model for a new constitution of France. And there was also a strong influence from Germany because there was relations between French and German philosophers. So if you want to understand the specificities of France, you have to look at Europe, in fact. It is an originality. I don't know if it is the same for each country in Europe, but I think that for France it is rather important. The third idea was to also enlarge the idea of intellectual life. In general, when you look at books about intellectual life, you are focused about historians, about philosophers, about writers mainly, and all other aspects of intellectual activities are more or less put aside. And the originality, or one of the originality of our project, was to introduce also new sectors such as sciences, such as human sciences, such as artistic activities, and also activities from outside the proper realm of culture, for example, popular cultures or regional traditions, which are in general put aside in the general histories because they are considered as less interesting. So it is, as you see, an idea of a global history, a large history, and an interactive history, both between France and other countries in Europe. And this explains why in this panel today we will also speak not only about France, but also of Europe.
Perhaps.
Thank you. So, so Laurent, you wanted to add a few words and maybe
about the project.
About the project and about the way it talks no longer about public intellectuals, but also about intellectual life. So we're no longer, this is not a history of all the great French thinkers who have made French thought. It is a history of what components go into make that intellectual life that we are talking about and that then define ideals and values.
Yes, we in order to recount the evolutions of French ideas, we had to look, Christophe just told about this, beyond the most famous public intellectuals of our national pantheon, like Hugo, Zola, Pasteur, Sartre, Foucault, and others. writing a history of intellectual life is not writing a history of the political commitment of French thinkers. It encompassed non-political ideas and we took some distance with what we thought was an over-politicized view of French intellectual life. In fact, we argue that this view, which certainly is one of the reasons why French public intellectuals got international fame, represents a good description of the norms of French intellectual life for only half of the 20th century, between the end of the First World War and the late 60s. In short, the narrative we built in this book is more inclusive in terms of the individuals we took into account, as well as it is more open to various types of ideas, looking beyond the sole political realm or political field. There is another thing we focused on, and Christophe also talked briefly about this. We focused on the transformations of the French public sphere, of the cultural, scholarly, and scientific institutions, of the media, of course, and we looked also at the demography of educated audiences. We tried to consider the various transnational relations of French intellectual milieus, how French ideas were exported abroad, and how they were influenced by or attracted to ideas coming from other countries like England or Germany in the 20th century. Last but not least, this project of writing a new history of French intellectual life also had some kind of political goals. Anti-intellectualism is currently quite strong in France, as it is in many countries. A lot of conservative public intellectuals are questioning the creativity of French thinking and ideas, and they hold that there is a decline of our culture. Our book is indirectly addressing these populist tendencies. We certainly did not want to defend a nationalist stance on French intellectual life, but we tried to show that what appeared as a decline in creativity had more to do with the loss of centrality of French intellectuals in the international circulation of ideas. Despite this loss of centrality, there are more ideas produced today in France than there used to be, and these ideas are more diverse, coming from more various social backgrounds than they were during the last century. Anti-intellectualism is not a new phenomenon in French intellectual life, and I don't know if I should talk about this right now, or maybe we can talk about the Sudeas project too, and then talk about anti-intellectualism if you wish.
So I think we'll stop there just for a second. What is interesting in this book is that we find in the project a number of words that are, it seems, important in the British world of publishing and history of ideas as well. If you talk to Penguin at the moment, Penguin's main problem is how are we going to publish books that are inclusive, as inclusive as possible? How are we going to reach out to new audiences who maybe do not represent the ideas of a happy few? I feel that in the project that we have here in La Vie Intellectuelle, you also have this this need, a feel of the necessity of rewriting a history of ideas that includes other. So, Christophe, you said non-political ideas, I think, and Laurent, you were talking about inclusivity and about taking into account other sources of information when writing a history of ideas. This is a common necessity, both for the Édition du Seuil in France or for Penguin here or other publishers here. We are all trying to find ways of rewriting those narratives that include other dimensions. Now, of course, academia has been doing this for a long time, and we are all specialists of this or that field, and those fields have existed. But it is in the published incarnation of these ideas that we are finding the need for new formats. Now, Sudhir Hazare Singh's book that he was also going to be talking about tonight was also an attempt to rewrite a history of French thought that could be read. The subtitle, I think, was An Affectionate Portrait of French Intellectual Life. So that could be...
of an intellectual people.
An affectionate portrait of an intellectual people.
Yeah.
So trying to rewrite, again, a history of ideas that takes into account also an element of emotional or subjective connection to these ideas. So again, we find different dimensions coming in. And I must say, in French, Soudir's book is translated as ce pays qui aime les idées. So this country, France, that loves ideas. We have a little bit of an ironic twist there. Ludovic, I think you were going to give us a little comparative reflection on these two books. And Ludovic is also the l'avocat du diable, so
the devil's advocate
in this story, since he is the economic historian, and he is bringing in yet another dimension, which is l'histoire économique.
Okay. So as we said, two books have come out in France within the last year. Soudir has arising ce pays qui aime les idées, how the French think, and La vie intellectuelle en France, a collection of essays, of articles edited by Christophe Charles and Laurent Jean-Pierre. Both publications allow a large readership to regain familiarity with and perhaps also renew their confidence in a large array of hopes and a body knowledge that intellectuals have brought about over the year in various sectors, politics, economics, culture, and the arts. The two books, I should say, are considerably different. Soudir's is a succinct personal essay, an essay, underpinned by his own previous historical inquiries, in particular his work on Napoleon, the Republican thinkers of the second half of the 19th century, like Vacherot, Fouillet, and De Gaulle. Un pays qui aime les idées is a vision of someone who is constantly liaising between several cultures, Paris, Oxford, and Lille-Maurice, Mauritius. Un pays qui aime les idées is also an intellectual portrait of France based on a number of recurrent dominant traits, such as its notorious Cartesianism. Tracing the lineage of these prevailing characteristics allows the author not so much to judge France, but rather to appreciate its idiosyncrasy. By contrast, the volume edited by Christophe Charles and Laurent Jean-Pierre has an approach that is more clearly historical and sociological, and is influenced both by the Annales school and Bourdieu's sociology, as it redefines period and various fields of study, actors and footsie. It is a collection of paper which bid farewell to the old idols of the historian tribe, to use the word of François Simillon in 1903, three idols, the individual, the chronological, and the political. Both books have very different intentions. But what is striking, however, is that this seems to come to rather similar conclusions. France, still extremely centralized state, a pyramid-shaped class of intellectuals, tensions, controversies, and the often competitive nature for the better and for the worse of public intellectual debate. The EV machinery, the state, administration, the long-standing polarity between the religious and the secular. Both books allow to better appreciate the nuances of these French traits. Summarizing a book is always a perilous and uneasy exercise. But if I were to bring forward two main ideas, this is what I would say. Firstly, that intellectual life is in France is not so much in decline. Rather, it just has been temporarily eclipsed and has metamorphosed and adapt accordingly. Secondly, that creativity and imagination are a dominant characteristic of French intellectual life. Soudir has arising often calls upon the notion of imaginaire in French. I will take the liberty to associate it with the neighboring notion of imagination. I am not thinking of the erreur voltigeante, which the philosopher Alain had in mind, but rather the opposite idea, namely that imagination leads to a better understanding of reality. This is what Jean Starobinsky says about imagination. It is, first the quotation in French, because it's a wonderful phrase in French. C'est un pouvoir d'écart grâce auquel nous nous représentons les choses distantes et nous distançons des réalités présentes. L'imagination, parce qu'elle anticipe et prévoit, sert l'action, dessine devant nous la configuration du réalisable avant qu'il ne soit réalisé. En ce premier sens, l'imagination coopère avec la fonction du réel, puisque notre adaptation au monde exige que nous sortions de l'instant présent, que nous dépassions les données du monde immédiat,
pour nous emparer en passé, en pensée, d'un avenir d'abord indistinct. In English, the capacity to step back, it is, imagination is a capacity to step back, thanks to which we can have representations of a distant object and distance ourselves from the present realities. Imagination, continues Starobinsky, because it allows us to anticipate and foresee self-action, draws and configures for us the contours of what is feasible before it is being carried out. In the first acceptation of the term, imagination cooperates with the reality function, la fonction de réalité, since adapting to the world demands that we transcend the present moment and the data of the immediate physical world in order to take possession intellectually of a future that has not yet been taken shape. My talk and what I am going to say here is in part inspired by the two short entries I wrote for La Vie Intellectuelle, thanks to Laurent, Jean-Pierre, and Christophe Charles, and two short entries which both focus on economic ideas. Indeed, I do believe that both these entries allows us to foreground how the economical aspect of social intelligence and imagination has for a long time already defined intellectual life. The first entry is about the so-called utopian socialist, those associated with Saint-Simon, Fourier, the dissident republicans such as Buchez and Leroux, the communists of the 1840 turning point such as Étienne Cabé, and finally Proudhon. What has been rediscovered and discussed over the last 20 years or so is the realist aspect of their utopias, which in the early days of industrialization tried to answer the question of what a just society is, and attended a few experiments in order to answer that question. This is what Louis Blanc says on that matter. I quote, "What are utopias? A utopia is an activist idea. It is often an idea that will come true tomorrow and is therefore the truth in a revolutionary state." End quote. His colleague Constantin Pecker added, I quote, to live by ideals in an utopia is to live in the future. My favorite quote now on the matter is by George Sand. En français, comment les utopies se réalisent? Point d'interrogation. C'est toujours autrement et mieux. In English, this is how utopia come true, always differently and better. With the second entry I contributed to La Vie Intellectuelle, I made a big leap forward on a good century, and it focused on the reception of Keynesian ideas in France after 1945, in particular the ways they were used by politicians such as Pierre Mendès-France. In this case, again, imagination underpins an ambitious program of reforms, which claims the right to choose to govern the economy within the framework of a modern republic.
So we have all in this volume, something which is both a summary of a very, I quote, centralized intellectual life, centralized in part the city of Paris and in all sorts of centralized French institutions. But we have also something, and through what Ludovic has just been saying, that goes back to projects that were very much the product of an era of 1848 or of those utopias that have made the grounds of a part of our intellectual life of the 19th and 20th century. So we're going back to those utopias, to the way they were realized or not, and to the what you call the realist aspects of those utopias. So the reality, the economic reality in part that they were grounded in. Do you want to say a bit more about that French, the place of that history of economic thought, Ludovic, or shall we move back to the more general? I think you wanted to talk about the contribution of economic history to a more general intellectual history.
Yes, I want to do this in contrasting these two books with another book.
So there's another book in play.
Yes, which was published exactly at the same time in France. So I can continue.
So a recent publication, I think it's so Le Négationnisme Économique.
Yes,
perhaps you must be.
Perhaps you can explain what this book is.
It's a book by two economists who basically said that economy is mainly an experimental science. a science based on experience. It was also a proposal by this was also proposed by François Simillon at the beginning of the 20th century, but here in a very, very different perspective and a very, very different spirit, because it's a very intolerant view on what is the core of economic reasoning today. So they said basically in their book that first economics is an experimental science, so an objective science, a positive science, a science close to discussion and close to the profane. Second, that neutral economists must be at the front of the discipline in economics, because they are not polluted by their ideological or political options. And then third, that the other economists from other paradigms in economics, from Keynesian institutionalist, Marxist economist, are outside the field of science in economics. So it's a very, very brutal and a very violent pamphlet and very intolerant pamphlet, which was published exactly at the same time as the Christophe Charles and Laurent Jean-Pierre book.
So while we have both attempts to rewrite an inclusive or a wider intellectual history of our shared ideas and ideals, at the same time we do have these pamphlets coming out of a form of necessity, again, of finding new versions and new narratives. When I saw this book come out, so it's by Le Cahuc and Zilberberg, and the title in French is Le négationnisme économique, comment s'en débarrasser, so economic negationism and how to get rid of it. It's a pamphlet, and every economist I know said this is a very dangerous book. It's making dangerous affirmations, and we're going to have to fight with this anti-economist and this anti-intellectual trend for the next few years.
Yes.
How can we now think about that anti-intellectualism and compare it maybe with, I mean, anti-intellectualism is not new, and that sort of pamphlet coming out against intellectuals and economists is not a completely unheard of thing in intellectual history. Could you talk a little bit about this longer perspective on anti-intellectualism?
In this case, I think that it's not exactly anti-intellectualism. It is more the idea that there is a closed definition of science and no other definition than the definition that these two authors are explaining. And this is a regression to a sort of positivism, this idea that you have no option outside of this definition. But as you know, in human sciences, the options, even the scientific options, are linked also to moral or political or ideological preferences. You cannot say that you may be neutral when the issues are concerning the life of human beings. It's not like when you are studying atoms or studying cells in biology. You are inside the science at the same time that you are a scientist. So you cannot say that you are outside of the scenery. And this negation of that this is not human science but a sort of experimental or objectivist science is a sort of regression to a very positivist and absurd vision, which was one of the options which have been suppressed during the idea of during the history of economy, politics, or politics, and so on. So it's based on the idea that we have now big data, that you may compare enormous amounts of statistics, and through this comparison, you have a sort of experiment, as you may have when you are studying atoms in a big collision, cyclotrons, and so on. But these two authors forget a very important thing, that the big data, perhaps they exist, but they have been constructed by people who had projects, who had ideas, who wanted to do something with these data. It is not just like results who are looked at a screen which are inscribed by just mechanics or machines. It's also a human construction. You have defined what you will define as salary, as work, as strike, as inflation, and so on. All these are construction by a paradigm. It's not only brutal and neutral facts. And it's interesting to see that this scientism wants to suppress the discussion, in fact. And it is the complete opposite of what science must be. Science must propose ideas, must propose interpretation, must propose solutions, but it does not close the discussion. You have to evaluate. And we very well know that even in science like physics or biology, there are always discussions, even if you have some global paradigm or facts which are accepted by the main scientists. There are always progress and there are always contribution who says that these results are not explained by our paradigm, so we will go further. So it's a very restrictive and reactive definition of science when compared even in domains which are not like human sciences. So it's interesting to see that the illusion of the new data which are produced in massive quantity by the new programs of the big databases and so on gives the illusion of a power of the scientists which can suppress the idea that there is discussion. And this may be very dangerous, I think, for intellectual life if you take this idea.
And Laurent, on this question of intellectual life, anti-intellectualism, and the need, the sort of need for fact or for other types of facts.
Yeah. I think we just talked about a controversy in economics in France, where some scientists are saying, some researchers are saying, basically there is only one truth. And there is only one way to build truth or to build facts in our discipline, and this is experimental economics. You have these tendencies within science and within academia on the one side, and on the other side you have very strong relativist or anti-intellectualist tendencies, saying basically, no, there is not only one truth; there are many truths. There are alternative facts, and there is a post-truth situation right now.
Which brings us back into this main strand that we've been following all through the evening
absolutely.
Post-truth, or what truth is there before and after post-truth? What are we going to do?
Absolutely, and so I think those two tendencies are, of course, are not even fighting. I mean, they are just living their lives within intellectual life. These people basically refusing discussion, as Christophe said, refusing debates within science, and people saying, yes, in fact, we have no certainties, and so there are a lot of facts, and even journalists. And so, I mean, the book was aiming mostly... was basically fighting, even though it was not our first goal, it was fighting against this anti-intellectualist trends, which are not only French. I mean, they are worldwide right now. They are growing in many countries. Think about Turkey, think about Russia, think about the US, of course, think about the Philippines, think about Hungary, think about Poland. In many, many different countries, I mean, researchers, writers, artists are despised by state power holders, and they are threatened, and they are even dismissed,
prosecuted,
and persecuted. And I think this tendency is growing. I mean, so this is not only anti-intellectualism within the world of ideas. I mean, this is anti-intellectualism within society. And so this is something we wanted to historicize and to analyze, and one of the things we we found is that, of course, anti-intellectualism is nothing new. I mean, it's a recurrent movement within societies and within intellectual worlds. It has cycles, and one of the results of the book is to say, usually you have a strong rise of anti-intellectualism after political crisis. After the First World War in France, after the Second World War, after the end of the Empire, after May 68, there is a rise of anti-intellectualism because some people are saying if there was a crisis, it's because of some intellectuals who were...
Utopist.
Yeah, utopist. I don't know. We were, in fact, more too influential, and we were spreading false ideas, and in fact, killing the morale of the nation and of the population. So you have this cycles of anti-intellectualism, and I think we can say that we are currently living one. And then there is another question, and I think I will just finish with this for now. If you look at anti-intellectualism, of course, a lot of people who are anti-intellectualist are also nationalists. But in fact, the features of anti-intellectualism are very common in many countries. I mean, you have always the same type of arguments. Intellectuals are far from action, distant from ordinary experiences, from ordinary people. They know nothing about political life. I mean, you have many commonplaces that are the same everywhere. So there is a kind. It's a paradox because there is a kind of. An international of nationalist of anti-intellectualist, and this is something we have to analyze if we are to talk about the European public sphere.
Thank you very much. So we've talked about the question of a new history of ideas, about the inclusivity or not of that history of ideas. We've talked about the passion for fact and a kind of need to define fact and a relation to truth. We've talked about the internationalization of anti-intellectualism. I'll just ask one last question, which is, as historian of ideas now, talking about post-truth and talking about the current debates that are happening at the moment, what should we do with this post-truth notion? Is it a post-modernism in another form? Is it a post-postmodernism? Is it relativism? Where are we going to categorize this strange word of 2017?
Christophe? I have something to say, but I just talked to...
I think that if we use this instrument of history to see how our period may be defined by comparison with other period, I think that, which is common in all this period where there are doubts about history, it is that the vision of the future is blurred. There is no idea that future may be better or that future may be in some direction or in another direction, but with a direction. I think that people are lost. They don't see what would be the next step. They have the experience that the preceding step was deceiving or was not what they hoped, and so they are very dubious of what we can do now. I think that is the explanation why the elections in particular are so surprising, because the polls are always what the people don't wait for. Some people were called to be elected and others are elected. Decisions would be submitted to referendums and people hoped something and it's the reverse which occurred. So it shows that there is a great indecision, a great doubt about what to do. And the politicians are not convincing, or those who are convincing are only convincing negatively. Because they don't want something, but they don't say what they want really, because they don't know themselves, I think. I think that's this. If you compare to other periods, like, for example, after the Second World War, the situation was very dramatic. Europe had experienced enormous devastation, very big crimes have been committed, and so on. So the future should be seen as very anxiously viewed. But on the reverse, there was some decision to say, we go further. We have a new project. We want to go on another direction, and we don't want to remain on what produced these horrors. And now there is not such a convincing or interesting view of the future, because perhaps the past is not so horrible. On the contrary, people are regretting the past. People say it was better in the 60s, or it was better in the 70s, and so on. And this regret impeach people to conceive another future, I think. And this is the reason why people are so dubitative of what they can do or what would be their next step. I think that politicians are just the illustration of that, because their politics are changing very quickly, or they are saying something for the elections and they are doing other things when they are elected, and so on. So it shows that themselves are very dubious of what they have to do.
And
so people who have elected them are also very dubious of what was the use to elect them. And think that it's a situation which could not be solved if there is no new collective definition of a new future, I think.
I just want to add something. Is the fact that these three dimensions are linked. First, utopia, the absence of utopia and our project today. Two, this rise of anti-intellectualism and populism.
Yeah.
And three, the rise also of the figure of the expert, and especially in political economy, and the fact that this expert, and one of the main aspect of this expertise is the fact that a world where extreme inequalities are evident are a kind of natural phenomena. And in this context, you have really difficulties to have a projection or an utopia, or what George Sand said in 1844, les utopies arrivent autrement et mieux et... Yeah. And it, I think that these three aspects are very, very important to be analyzed in the same ensemble.
So, a connection between utopia, anti-intellectualism, a real question about the role of experts. I think it's time to open questions. Are there questions on these different notions and proposals? Yes.
I am a bit confused today, Mike. You have talked about all this. Without at any point mention political power or economical power, or that there are interests in this. I mean, the reason why we are so confused is probably partly because some people want us to be confused. They tell us alternative facts. They tell us that this is one that we know, many, many economists, they know what's happening in the world, but that's not what you read in the papers or see in the media. Some people actually know what is happening and why. So, and there are some people we call politicians and power people. They call it Colombia. They have an interest in making us confused, isn't that right?
Do we want to take a second question?
You're equating populism with anti-intellectualism.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been quite sure what populism means, and maybe you can throw some light on that for me. I think in South America it used to mean it was a democratic government the Americans didn't like. But populism equals anti-intellectualism. Does that not... Could you not possibly read that as the intellectualism that works for you and your class of people actually doesn't work for those people who are turning out to be quite a significant number of people in the country, say, so in Britain for Brexit, the intellectualism, the expertism of the, dare I say, the Labour Party and the elite that are very London-based turned out not really to work for the majority or a lot of people outside London who didn't see the benefits of the liberal openness and all of that. So could you just help me a little bit with that?
I think, would you like to answer, Laurent? And then I'll take two more questions.
Yeah. I would like first to answer to your question, if I understood it well. I agree with you. I think, one of the questions we are raising is the question of the distance between intellectual worlds and the world of the politicians, the world of the journalists, and one of the results we have about France, I don't know what you would say about England, is that this distance has been growing recently. And that, in fact, politicians, even left-wing politicians, which traditionally have been close to intellectual milieus, don't care about new ideas. They don't care about social science research. They don't care about good works, about economic inequalities in the world. In fact, even a former French finance minister was proud of saying that he didn't want to read Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, despite the fact that this book was a worldwide discussion, and despite the fact that the Obama administration was receiving Piketty to listen to him, even though he didn't produce anything. So anyway, I'm just saying, yes, there is this distance between the French political world and the French intellectuals, which has been quite new. And this is something we are asking ourselves about. And I think in other countries, I mean, this distance existed historically much more. And I don't know if it's growing or not, but I'm just saying for the French context, it's quite new. And of course, I mean, there are interests to create confusion and not to be interested in solid, robust research, for example, to illuminate the public debate. Regarding your question about equating populism and anti-intellectualism, I agree with you. In fact, I use the word populism, but I don't like it, and I never use it. And usually I use it only with hyphens because I believe populism, if you look at it historically, has always been produced by intellectuals. I mean, populist ideas coming from the US, coming from Russia, coming from maybe England today, are not ideas of the people. They are ideas of intellectuals produced against other intellectuals in the name of the people. And I don't think populism is a product or an intellectual product of the people themselves.
Debate is open.
So what I was suggesting is that it's philosophers who are looking at the interests of their own class rather than considering the interests of all those people who are voting against. And I'm not sure you really addressed that.
I didn't talk about the Brexit vote, yeah.
Well, it's not specifically talking about the Brexit vote, but I think maybe in France as well, there's a huge community in France who is feeling disenfranchised from philosophers, maybe. But is that because you're not understanding their perspective on the world of politics and economics now? Is that perhaps, and certainly my sense in England is that it's because the London metropolitan elite really isn't understanding the perspective of the people in the provinces.
I get your point.
But this is an expression of the growing inequalities inside our societies, in fact. Yes. In a way, obviously.
And it is also linked to the narrowing of economic debate and the fact that if you look at the economics on the long run, on the economics as a discipline, you had a long history of controversies between competing visions of economy. You had the Marxist economy, you are institutionalism, you are Keynesian, neo-Keynesianism, and you have a large range of options, and all these options were engaged in debates. And now with this position, and especially with this position on experimental economics, you don't have this. So you don't have the fact that they are aware of the problem you mentioned concerning the problem of the common people and the mainly inequalities.
Can I take two more questions? There were hands. There was one there, and yeah. Is there a second mic? Yeah, we can.
Hi. So my question is, intellectuals are kind of seen this as if this kind of pure world that knows best for the lower socioeconomic groups. But also the reason why the lower socioeconomic groups doesn't trust the intellectuals is possibly because some have an agenda and have a political agenda or are part of a corporate lobbyist agenda. So, for example, in respect to climate change or WHO, you have scientists which, said tobacco was very healthy for many years because they were paid for by the tobacco industry.
Absolutely.
So you have to also understand from an intellectual level that you have a disconnection to the people and to why they mistrust some of the information they're trying to give out, basically.
And there was a second suggestion here, and I'll come to you afterwards.
My question is quite linked to this question. In fact, is I'm French as well, so I can speak maybe of France a bit, but people are more and more educated in France, let's say, compared to a few years ago, and you are saying that your message or intellectual message are not here anymore. People don't listen to it so much than in the past. What can, for you, explain that, knowing that you have more and more information? And my last point is just a comment. I'm a bit surprised about all this debate and the title of this debate, European ideas and ideal. I didn't hear once Europe or European ideal, ideal or ideas in what you said. So I'm a bit surprised of the discussion so far, but thank you.
So Laurent, do you want to take this over?
About Europe, you're right. I mean, we didn't have time to talk about Europe, but yeah, I mean, the idea was to ask ourselves where a stronger European public intellectual sphere would be a good answer against this anti-intellectualist tendencies growing in Europe and elsewhere. And the answer is not easy, but we won't go on in this direction. About your remark on, I don't think this panel was about pleading for intellectuals and for truth and for the capacity of all the intellectuals to produce truth. Of course, there are corrupted intellectuals, and of course, Robert Proctor did a great work to show how scientists collaborated with the tobacco industry for decades and still now, in fact. And I agree with you. I mean, in fact, a lot of intellectuals are not doing their job. I mean, it's evident. And so, yeah, I mean, we are not pleading. We're not saying intellectuals are always right. We're just saying, I mean, it's in, we are just arguing about a new way of considering the history of intellectual life, extending, basically, our understanding beyond the more public figures. I mean, this is the only thing we tried to say, I think.
I think what I was trying to say is, in fact, that is why there is a rise in anti-intellectuals, because there's a lot of division and there's a lot of misinformation. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult to know who to believe and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And unless you have developed critical research,
I agree with you.
Firstly, the average Joe is not going to, and will not have to run through critical research. They won't know, and therefore it's really difficult to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
But that was what I was trying to say. I wasn't saying in particular your panel. I was just saying mm-hmm. general experts.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
I'm afraid I can take two more questions before giving one of our panelists the chance to wrap up on the European public sphere. There was a question here.
Thank you. I tried to make it quick. I'm not an expert, but I'm wondering something regarding the comments on experimental economics and positivism. I wonder if there has been a threshold on the availability of data moving from pure theoretical models towards the use of big data. So I would like to ask your opinion on the rise and reject of the mentioned experimental economics due to the availability of data rather than a change in thinking towards only one truth, as I was said.
And there was a second question over there in the sixth row. Yep.
Il demande s'il y a un seuil à partir duquel les experimental economics peuvent être plus valides, notamment le seuil.
Thanks. I was going to ask about, we talked a bit about economics and experts and information, but I think people used to say it's the economy, stupid. Kind of way, what we learned recently is actually people are okay. People talk about inequality, but actually the people in England and in the US are doing economically okay, and they voted to say we don't care about expertise, we don't care about economics, we care about narratives or meaning or... Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think part of the problem is that in the discussion, like somebody in a way complained about a bit, that there's a lot of discussion on intellectual life. There's a serious problem in the world now, and I don't get any succor from this discussion. Like, we need powerful ideas from the left and from intellectuals to go forward. And what do you guys have to offer us in terms of understanding and changing this world that's going bad quickly?
Thank you. So we need a quick answer to two very, very leading questions. Laurent, Ludovic, would you like to... The first question is
just
very
the
much
first
about...
Question. The question is not on the fruitful dimension of experimental economics. It is evident that experimental economics is one important part of our discipline, of our science. Is the critic is... mainly that for Kayuk and Zilberberg, for example, it is the only method, and it is the only method because it is a positive and objective method in economics. And this thought by Kayuk and Zilberberg is very, very dangerous because it's close entirely the discussion concerning economic issues and economic matters. And the fact that on these matters we have to discuss, and we have to discuss the finalities and the ends of economic activities, production, but also distribution of wealth. And it's a political, and as classical economists from Adam Smith to Marx said, it's mainly a political problem, and it's not, and there is no objective and positive solution for these issues.
And Laurent, so about the capacity of maybe European public sphere or the structure at the moment of a European public sphere and its capacity to produce new ideas, or maybe weak links, which was another suggestion you were making earlier. But
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the question was more was wider. It was like basically, do powerful ideas exist today, and are you defending some of them here in this panel? No, I mean the only thing I think we tried to argue about was to say, I mean, there are much more many ideas in going around, and there are much more robust facts and robust truth circulating in the world than we think. And so we have to be more aware and more careful about them. And relativism and skepticism is not an answer. Basically, this is the only thing we try. And confusion is not an answer. So I mean, the main question at the end of the book was basically the political question about intellectual life has to do with what some people call now the economy of attention. I mean, how can in fact there are too many ideas. It's not the problem is not the scarcity of ideas. The problem is not the rarity of ideas. The problem is the overload of ideas. The overload even of progressive ideas, utopias. But we don't see them because they are hidden somewhere in the forest. And so the question is how can we see them? And this is not only a narcissistic question for intellectuals in a panel at the LSE. I mean, this is a very big political question for anybody.
So a plea for robust facts and also a central place of economic thought in our intellectual life today. Thank you very much, Ludovic Frobert, Laurent Jean-Pierre, and Christophe Charles. Thank you all for the debate and for a great